Okay, I think it's time to start. So, Jari-Mikko, welcome. You may introduce yourself and start giving the show.
All right. Hello, everybody. My name is Jari-Mikko Meriläinen. I am a postdoctoral researcher here at the JSBE. I graduated from the University of Vaasa about 4 years ago. Then I visited the European Central Bank for 1 year, where I worked as a PhD trainee. And after the ECB, I returned to Finland to JSBE. I'm here on a grant. I've been here for 2 years now and will continue for maybe 2 years more. My research interests are banking regulation, financial stability mostly. Currently, I study bank asset liquidity together with Professor Juha Junttila. We already have published one study about liquidity, and we are working on another one. I don't participate very much in teaching. I have these two lectures on banking regulation on this Juha's course, Principles of Banking, but I actively participate to thesis supervision. For example, I have six students. I have my own bachelor thesis group. I supervise six students. I also participate in supervising your thesis, I mean, thesis of the students in your program. So maybe we will meet in the future as well. But today I'm going to speak about systemic importance. Tomorrow we will focus on bank capital and liquidity. Last year I started my lecture was speaking about the corona crisis. 1 year ago, we were about.
Jari-Mikko, can you share the screen to Zoom participants too?
Oh no, sorry. I tried to do that.
Yeah, thanks.
Okay, I tried to do that, but I
Thank you.
currently failed. Okay, sorry. So last year we were roughly about here. We were wondering that what's going to happen in the future. Because this is, I have a few example banks. Deutsche Bank, everybody knows Deutsche Bank. It is the German bank giant. Then there is this Nordea from Finland, Sweden, Norway, and Denmark. Santander is a Spanish bank that used to be a local bank in a city called Santander, but today it's one of the largest banks in Europe. Well, this dashed line here is Santander. They had to book quite massive losses during the corona crisis because they are very prominent in the UK and in Spain that both suffered quite badly of the corona crisis. But now we know that the economy recovered quite rapidly, surprisingly well. So there was just a spike in Santander's losses. They had to book massive loan loss provisions for the losses that incurred in the UK and in Spain and in Latin America as well. But that was just 1 quarter. It's about 8 to 9 billion euros of loan loss provisions. As for the background of these first lectures or two lectures, I focus on the changes in the banking regulations because this financial crisis of 2008 and 2009, it prompted some very major changes in the banking regulation. And this financial crisis, it was followed by the sovereign debt crisis or the Eurozone crisis. Lessons were learned also during this Eurozone crisis. The contemporary regulation before the year 2007, it's a neglected some very important factors. So the regulation was improved based on the lessons, on the experiences learned during these two economic crises. And also not only the regulation changed, but also banking supervision in the euro area changed because it's now mostly managed by the SSM or the single supervisory mechanism, which means in practice that is it is the ECB that supervises most of the euro area banking sector. Before this, it was the national supervisors that supervised even the largest banks in the euro area. This has now changed. Many of you probably are so young that probably you don't remember this Lehman Brothers. I think it was the third largest investment bank in the world, and it collapsed during the financial crisis in September 2008. It ignited the turmoil in the markets, stock markets, they collapsed, interbank markets, they froze because of the uncertainty caused by the collapse of this Lehman Brothers. Some say that these banks should have been bailed out to prevent the problems. Maybe it would have helped, or maybe it would have just postponed the problems a little bit. It's hard to say, but some say that it was a mistake to let this bank to fail. But in any case, it was a systemically important bank, and the new regulation tries to avoid the collapse of such banks that are important for the banking system. But the financial crisis, it had already begun even before the collapse of the Lehman Brothers, even if it's the most frequently mentioned example of the financial crisis. For example, in Europe or in the UK, this Northern Rock bankrupted already in September 2007. That is 1 year before the collapse of Lehman Brothers. And according to classification by Leiden and Valencia, there were systemic banking crises in many countries, Austria, Belgium, Denmark, Germany, Greece, and so on and so on. We didn't have a banking crisis in Finland. Probably that is because we had a quite dramatic banking crisis in 1992. So maybe our banks simply were so careful because of the shock caused by this banking crisis of the 90s. But famous examples are the banking crisis of Iceland, for example, or Ireland. Public sector interventions were needed to ensure financial stability, or in other words, it's taxpayers' money that was needed very much. There is an excellent study by Harla, well, I don't know how to pronounce these names, Treschler and Schnabel, 2014. It is published in the Journal of Finance. They show that these bailouts were so costly that it actually increased sovereign debt crisis. That is, our governments became indebted because of these bailouts, which in turn weakened the financial sector because it eroded the value of the guarantees given by the governments for these banks. I have copied this figure from this study of this Harla and others. Well, the dashed line, it's the bank credit default swap. Well, you can interpret it as credit risk. And the solid line, it is the sovereign CDS. You can interpret it as the credit risk of the government of Ireland. Here is the banking crisis. It is the vertical line where Ireland announced the bank bailouts. You can see that the credit risk of the banking sector, it collapses. I mean, it decreases very steeply, but begins to increase again because the credit risk of the government of Ireland begins to increase. the Saharu and others, they know that this is because the governments of Ireland, and not only Ireland, but also Greece, Portugal, and Spain, they became indebted because of these bailout programs, because they were simply so expensive. Hence, this is what we want to avoid in the future. There is a fundamental change in the regulation, and it is the recognition of systemic importance. Failing systemically important banks devastate the whole banking sector. And if these banks are global, as they often are, they send shocks through the global financial system. And therefore, the regulation is designed to prevent the collapse of these systemically important institutions. For example, these Lehman Brothers. And the basic principle to prevent these banks from collapsing is this expected impact framework. If we have an estimate for a bank's loss given default, that is, if a bank defaults or if it fails, the size of losses in case of the default, that is, loss given default, then we have an estimate for a bank's probability of default. Taken together, we get the expected impact. And SIB means systemically important banks. So we want to get the EQL expected impact, which means that the expected impact of a systemically important bank would EQL that of a non-systemically important bank. And this is done by decreasing the probability of default of of the bank that is systemically important. And it is done by requiring to hold more capital. This decreases their probability of default because it takes the banks further away from the default. Probably you are very much aware of the basic or other primary banking functions, but just a reminder, the primary functions are that they accept deposits and grant loans, they provide a safe haven for depositors, and they also manage payment traffic. I mentioned these because these are the functions that are especially protected by these frameworks that are used to designate a systemically important bank. So we come to the problem that what is systemic importance and how do we recognize a systemically important bank from a less significant institution. There is a framework for this. It's published by Basel Committee. This global systemically important banks assessment methodology and the additional loss absorbency requirement. It was published in 2011. That is, it's about 3 years after the collapse of Lehman Brothers. Mostly these new regulations they were published around 2010, 2015. It means that the work began during the financial crisis, or in some cases during the sovereign debt crisis. This is already integrated as part of Basel III. And by the way, just a side mention, you probably have heard this too big to fail many times. It should not be used in analytic discussion. If you are, for example, writing your thesis, do not use this too big to fail. Today, it's known as systemically important institutions. But this is another way to approach this term. Everyone knows what is too big to fail. But if you hear someone speaking about a systemically important institution, it means that this bank is too big to fail. And that's why it's protected, because it cannot fail. But in any case, this should not be used, at least not in the academic discussion. This is, well, this shortens global systemically important bank. It shortens to GSIB. And this methodology published by Basel Committee, it is known as the GSIB methodology. And it is used to designate banks that are globally systemically important. Mostly this methodology is indicator based. That is, we get code numbers. It's a sum of several subscores, but it includes some subjective elements. Every bank is calculated a GSIB score. And if this GSIB score is larger than a certain threshold, then the bank is designated as a systemically important bank. There is a cutoff, it's 130 basis points. I will return to this later. But if the GSIB score for a bank is lower than this cutoff point, then the bank is not a GSIB. It's quite simple. We have just a cutoff point, a simple divider that divides banks into two groups, those that are globally systemically important and those that are not. Well, it's quite obvious that bank size is one of the indicators in measuring systemic importance. And actually, I've been told by an expert that bank size has been used for measuring systemic importance, at least in some jurisdictions. So also the GSIB score, it includes a indicator or a sub score for a bank's size. In the GSIB, this variable is total exposures, which is quite close to total assets, except that it includes also off balance sheet exposures. In the GSIB methodology, bank variables are always measured relative to global aggregates in the same variables. That is, the indicators, they measure a bank's relative share of the global aggregate. Well, I have an equation here. We have a bank's GSIB score for a certain year. We take total exposures of a bank, and then we divide these total exposures by the total amount of bank exposures in the whole world and multiply it by 10,000 to get basis points. Basel actually discloses these denominators, these global aggregates. This is about 81 trillion euros, the total exposures. I mean, total amount of bank exposures in the world. So we get the size indicator, for example, for Deutsche Bank by taking the total exposure of Deutsche Bank and divide them by this 81 trillion. We get a quite small number because even the largest banks, they are quite small compared to the global aggregates. And this principle then is applied for each of the subscores. So this is the basic principle, the scope of the GSIB score, everything in the whole world, total exposures for bank size. There are also four other scores because the GSIB score is a sum of five separate scores. We have this score for bank size. Then we measure substitutability, interconnectedness, complexity, and also cross-jurisdictional activity. All these weights, I mean, all these subscores have a weight of 20%. It is called EQL weights, but in other words, it means that there are no weights. Interconnectedness, as the name implies, it means that how connected the bank is to other banks. Well, at least in theory, we could have banks that are relatively small, but that are so connected. We call those, those are called hubs, that if they fail, they cause disruption to the banking system because they are so very well networked. In reality, there are no such banks. They are the largest banks that, generally speaking, are the most connected. The number one here, I think it was BNP Paribas, the blue banks, they are all French banks. It seems that the French banks, they are very, very connected in the European banking system. But the
how well do we know how interconnected the bank is? Because it's obviously a private.
Oh, yeah. Well, I will return to this about this data issues, because very specific data is needed for this. It's very difficult to replicate these GSIP scores, even to some accuracy. But I will speak about this a bit more. So this score for interconnectedness consists of three items: intra-financial system assets and liabilities, and outstanding securities. I mean securities as liabilities. Then we have a score for substitutability. This means that if a bank fails, if it goes like poof, how easy it is to replace these banks. Short-term replaceability. These banks are expected to disrupt the banking system if they fail. This goes very accounting because the score for substitutability includes, for example, assets under custody, trading volume, and things like that. For an economist, this is quite exotic. And one really could ask that why assets under custody have a weight of 6.6% and why trading volume has a weight of 3.3%. Well, maybe there is a reason for this. Rationales for these variables or these weights, they are not disclosed in the GSIP document that is published by the Basel Committee. I bet they have arguments for this in the preliminary documents, but they do not disclose these preliminary documents. And this makes studying this GSIP score quite difficult. Complexity, then, well, I have written, this is a direct copy and paste from the regulation. The more complex a bank is, the greater the costs and time needed to resolve the bank. If a bank fails and if it's very complex, it becomes costly for the taxpayers to resolve the bank. Score for complexity consists of three items. Well, we have over-the-counter derivatives. Level three assets are assets that don't have a value. Value has to be approximated or estimated. Then we have securities for trading and available for sale securities. And finally, there is a subscore for cross-border activity. This is because these banks are the banks that transmit shocks around the world or across the global banking system. We have cross-jurisdictional claims and liabilities with an equal weight. Hence, we have five subscores, and these subscores are summed up and averaged. And the result is a bank-specific GSIP score for a given year that has a value between 0 and 10,000. 10,000, you can interpret it as 100%. It would mean that there was only one bank in the banking system. And these scores, they are very low, even for the largest banks. Largest banks like the Deutsche Bank or BNP or banks like that, Chinese banks, they have scores of 300 to 400. So it's about, well, if you interpret it as a size of the banking system, 3 to 4%. So I mentioned earlier that a bank is a GSIP if its GSIP score is higher than this cutoff point. which is 130 basis points. This is given by the regulator. And this cutoff point, it is the subjective part of this designation process. Even though they use cluster analysis to calculate these cutoff points, but in practice, this cluster analysis means that it is based almost on nothing. Cluster analysis, you can choose the method and you can choose the results quite well. So this is the subjective part of this GSIP designation process. But now that we have the list of GSIPs, we need to lower their default, probability of default. And it is done by giving these banks a GSIP capital buffer. It has to be met with tier one EQD. That is the EQD of the highest quality. Mostly this means investors' money or retained profits. And the higher is the GSIP score, the larger is the buffer. The bank has to hold this additional GSIP buffer on top of the required capital buffer. As a result, these GSIPs, they have more capital relative to risk-weighted assets than less significant institutions. There are several approaches for calculating banks these GSIP buffers, but the most commonly used is the bucketing approach. As the name suggests, this bucketing approach divides banks into buckets. The GSIP buffer is always larger for higher buckets. Currently, there are 5 buckets in this approach. The lowest bucket, it has a GSIP buffer rate of 1% of risk-weighted assets. And the highest, that is an empty bucket, it has a rate of 3.5% of risk-weighted assets. These are all public information. GSIP framework, cutoff score, and bucket thresholds. There is also an alternative approach, or precisely there are several alternative approaches. This expected impact approach uses a regression equation to estimate alpha and beta. And using then a derivation, we get the same EQL expected impact equation as that I showed before. But in practice, this estimating is very sensitive to outliers. This is, you get quite absurd results trying to estimate the buffer rates using this expected impact approach. That's why this bucketing approach is preferred. So here we have the buckets. These are also public information. We have about 30, well, I think it's precisely 30 GSIPs. This is a little bit surprising because we have US banks in the highest bucket. The top bucket it's always empty. This is to give banks incentives not to grow their systemic importance even more. Now we have 2 empty buckets because this Citigroup used to be the bucket number 4, but it was moved to the bucket number 3. Apparently because they have decreased their systemic importance. But we have 2 US banks, Citigroup and JP Morgan Chase, and also HSBC from the UK. I have found this a bit surprising because why is Bank of China in the second bucket together with Barclays or BNP Paribas? Here we have Santander that I spoke about. There is Mitsubishi from Japan, UniCredit from Italy.
Why they're not allowed to be like in first or second bucket, like bucket number 5 and 4?
The top bucket is always left empty to give banks incentives not to grow their systemic importance more. But now we have two empty buckets because this Citigroup used to be in the fourth bucket, so they could really remove the bucket number five, but it's probably left there. Well, I don't know why. Yeah.
So sorry, but is there any regulations or something like this group, like GCP is doing something like soy calls, so but banks can make it to this group?
Yeah, they can. If they grow their GCP score, here we had the, oh, sorry, wrong direction. Cut-off scores. These are the cut-offs for the GCP score. We calculate the score for each bank. If they get the score of 340, they get into bucket number four. If it's as high as 530 or between two, 629, it's in the bucket five. And if you lower your score, you get moved to a lower bucket. And if it's below this 130, the bank is not designated as a GSIP.
So you're kind of allowed to be in bucket number five, but you need to meet some of requirements to get this score.
Yeah, well, you need to have the high. Well, yes, it's based on the indicators.
Okay.
And the higher is the bucket, the higher is the GSIP buffer.
Thank you.
This is kind of the punishment for getting too big or too systemically important. Oh no.
Yeah.
Mikä se tämä on? En mä usko.
On se varmaan se.
Oikein mä hukkaan tähän.
Oliko se sitten tuossa?
Ei tässä. Oi rähkö.
Katsotaan, mä yritän sammistaa.
On, kun en mä usko, kun ei mä kuullutkaan sen putoavan. Okay. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you and we can actually see you also. So it's only about the presentation in there in the screen there.
Ah, okay.
It's not showing. So we can see your slides also.
Okay, well, I will continue.
Yeah.
Sorry, I accidentally kicked the computer.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
Something happened. Alpha and beta. Okay, it seems that the computer doesn't recognize the projector anymore.
Okay.
For some reason.
And both projectors are off.
No, they are on, but we simply see blue screens.
Okay. Yeah. So
it says that there is no signal.
Okay, so I suppose that the plug is now off from the computer or something like that.
Yeah, something like that. But we don't see anything. I try to move every.
So if the students there in the classroom, do you have any laptops? Then just connect to the Zoom and then you can follow the presentation from the laptop.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, most of them have a laptop.
Yeah. So just connect to the Zoom and follow the presentation from there.
Niin, en mä usko, että se on siitä kuulunut. Ah, sorry.
I think it's not the reason, because it really doesn't even fit there.
But like, I could hear something just dropped.
Is there
no.
Would it fit in the front?
Niin, kokeilla.
Okay,
we'll try to turn it off and on. Okay.
Okay, I'll just follow.
Yeah, thanks. Okay, in 2021, there are in total 30 of these G-SIPs. Nordea from the Nordic countries used to be on the list, but it was removed. I think it was in 2019. This is also public information. You can find the list online. 2020 list of global systemically important banks. Anyone could name most of these G-SIPs. Anyone who reads economic news. We had very famous banks from the US and Europe, China and Japan. And in practice, these subscores for interconnectedness and substitutability and so on, they all correlate with the score for bank size and also with each other. So why don't we simply use size for measuring systemic importance? I mentioned earlier that it actually has been used as a measure for systemic importance, at least in some countries. But in this subscores for interconnectedness, for example, they may change the ranking between these G-SIBs. If we have 30 G-SIBs, what is the most systemically important of them? It may differ on these subscores for substitutability or interconnectedness or complexity. But if we use only the indicator score for bank size, probably we would end up with the same list of these 30 G-SIBs. And now I come to the first question, this data, because from the academic point of view, lack of data prevents very much from replicating these G-SIB scores. Because regulatory data is needed for the score, and it is only the ECB and the national regulators that have access to this data. And even central banks, they may experience problems in estimating payments activity because there really is no commonly available data for payments activity, not even in central banks. The Basel Committee publishes the G-SIB scores and all the subscores for the designated G-SIBs, that is for these 30 banks. I found an excellent website where there is an interactive figure where you can list these banks. I was wondering that why do we have Chinese banks in the second bucket? Or completely missing from the list? Why do we have US banks in the highest bucket or the bucket number 3? Well, if you can see this figure, it shows that the Chinese banks, they actually...
Yeah.
Okay, good. Chinese banks actually are the largest banks in the world. We have this ICBC, it's the Industrial and Commercial Bank of China. It has the largest size score, but as you can see, its cross-jurisdictional score is quite low. And especially for the Agricultural Bank of China, the cross-jurisdictional score is as low as 34, which means that it operates mainly in China. Even if its size score, it's even bigger than that of, for example, J.P. Morgan. This MUFG, it is Mitsubishi United Financiers Group. It's the Mitsubishi Bank. But when you rank these banks by the size score, all the European banks are missing. It's the HSBC from the UK. That is on the only European bank on the list. And as you can see, the cross-jurisdictional score for the HSBC, it's quite massive. It's almost 700, highest of all these scores in this figure. And as you can see, JP Morgan, it was in the bucket number 3. It has a GSIB score of 421, when the maximum score, at least in theory, is 10,000. So these scores, they are quite low. But it's safe to say that this GSIB framework is a step forward. Now we protect the banks that are important for the banking system. It reduces the negative externalities that relate to banks that are aware of their significance. You probably have discussed moral hazard problems in context of banking. It may amplify risk-taking, reduce market discipline, distort competition, and so on and so on. This raises the question of why didn't have we anything like this before the financial crisis. But like I said, this new regulation, other changes in regulation, they are based on the lessons learned during the financial crisis. And this score is global because a national score would not account for cross-border consequences, which gets us to our second subject of this lecture. That is the OSI framework, which means other systemically important institutions. This OSI methodology is basically the GSIB framework applied to the national context. This GSIB was first and the OSI came second. This was first proposed by European Banking Authority in 2014. It's about 3 years later than the GSIB framework. Guidelines on criteria for the assessment of OSIs. Well, actually, the framework was proposed in 2012, but the first OSI score was introduced in 2014. So basically, the idea in the OSI framework is the same as in the GSIB framework, except that the objective is different. The GSIB framework is used to designate banks that are significant for the global banking system. This OSI is used to designate banks that are significant for domestic banking systems. For example, in Finland, we have 3 systemically important institutions. We have Nordea, we have this Osuuspankki group, that is the cooperative banking group in Finland. Then we have a specialized banks, it's municipality finance. The finances, well, as the name implies, it finances municipalities in Finland. None of these would be designated as systemically important banks by the GSIB framework. So we use this OSI framework to designate this and many other banks in the euro area as systemically important banks. So the OSI score, it is very close to the GSIP score because it's kind of a copy of it. The subscores, they have been slightly adjusted for a reason that they do not disclose. I have quite carefully read this publication by the EBA. They do not mention why they have made changes to the score, which is a bit frustrating. But the big difference between the GSIP score and the OSI score is in the denominator, because the GSIP score, in the GSIP score, the denominators were always, I mean, the indicator variables were always measured to global aggregates, but in the OSI framework, the denominator is national aggregate. That is, we measure German banks relative to German aggregates or Swedish banks relative to Swedish aggregates. And as a result, we have a score that measures a bank systemic, sorry?
Is there not any, because they don't disclose why they're doing things that they do, or the way they do it, is there not any sort of resistance to their...
Well, sorry, any sort of...
Is there not any resistance to their...
Well, maybe they have had a quite... I mean, maybe they have discussed this together with central banks, but now when I'm reading these documents as a researcher, they don't disclose anything why they have made changes. But I bet they have had dialogue with central banks and experts when they were at least preparing the preliminary documents for these scores. But it is really annoying to read this, why they have made changes and they don't disclose. It's not very democratic, in my opinion.
But from a competition perspective, is it allowed?
Well,
comparing to our banks or like all other countries, especially if this is like Eurozone.
Yeah.
So I would say like it's one central bank, but I'm doing whatever I want and I'm not telling anyone else.
Yeah.
Or like, for example, governor of the Finnish bank knows about this also, and he also thinks those were like other countries are not aware of this change at all.
Yeah. Well, it's difficult to answer that. Well, maybe it's a good question. Yeah. EBA, it's European Banking Authority. Because I don't precisely know what is their mandate. How much power do they have? Who they have to listen to?
On our hand, it's Germany who like remains power in Europe.
Yeah.
So it's like,
yeah, well, that's true. Yeah. Except tomorrow, I will speak more about the banking union and the single supervisory mechanism. It is the ECB that has the ultimate decision power when it comes to banking supervision. But still, we come to the question, why do they not disclose these changes that were made? It is a bit strange. When I was at the ECB, we had a project on this systemic importance, and we wondered to this aloud why they made changes to this score without disclosing. Maybe there is something political in it. Could be. But just like in the GSIP score, the range of scores in the OSI score is also from 0 to 10,000. The difference is that OSI scores are very often much larger than GSIP scores, because in some banking system, consider for instance Finland, a single bank may be a dominant player. Nordea in Finland is bigger than it's many times bigger than this cooperative banking group, for example. Together, they are larger than the rest of the banking system together. Thus, the outsized scores, they can be very large, and this is especially true for some subscores. Instead of 5 subscores, there are 4 of them in the outsized scores. Size score and interconnectedness score, they are identical to those of the GSIP score, but then we have differences. We have a score for importance, and then we have a score for complexity and cross-border activity. But the big difference is in the denominator. It's national instead of global. We calculate every bank asset in the country. In the size score, I mean, we take every single bank asset in the country and compare a bank's total assets to this denominator. We get the size indicator score. In the GSIP score, the denominator was total exposures, but in the OSI framework, it is changed as total assets. This is something that, again, is not disclosed. Why they changed this? Yeah, I don't know. But we have a ratio measuring a bank's global assets relative to all the bank assets in the banks that domicile in the same country. Just is that the scope of the variable still is global. So even if we, for example, have Nordea, we take every bank asset of Nordea, even if they locate outside of Finland. Therefore, if we have in small banking system, large internationally operating banks, they make domestic banks look less important. For example, when Nordea moved its headquarters from Sweden to Finland, it made Finnish banks look systemically less important. Doesn't really make much sense. I will return to this, but this is in any case how the OSI score is calculated. We take all the assets in the world and use those as the denominator. The subscore for importance is different from the GSIP framework. We have a variable for payment transactions, just like in the GSIP score. Then we have a variable for deposits and another for loans. And here is another one of these strange changes. The scope of the variables in these deposits and loans, it's not global, it's the European Union. This is, again, something that is not discussed. That's all in the publication by the EBA. Maybe there is, well, a colleague of mine proposed that maybe there is something political behind this. And then the subscore for complexity, it's a combination of GSIP scores for complexity and cross-border activity. In the GSIP score, we had a separate subscore for these cross-jurisdictional liabilities and claims, and then this value of over the counter derivatives, it was part of this complexity score. They are just taken together in this OSI score, but as a result we have a very familiar looking score. You can easily see the similarities between GSIP score and the OSI score. We have indicators. In GSIP we have 5. In the OSI, we have 4. The result is a score between 0 and 10,000. The designer of this OSI score admits that the score, it does not necessarily capture a systemically important bank, which is simply because banking sectors, they are so very much different in different countries. For example, we have small countries like Lithuania. Then we have big countries like Germany. It's easy to be, well, at least relatively easy to be a dominant player in some subscore in Lithuania. Probably many banks there don't have that much cross-jurisdictional assets or liabilities, or for example, over-the-counter derivatives. Therefore, if there is one bank that is larger than the rest of them, its subscore for that variable, it's close to 10,000. The OSI methodology also includes a second stage where banks are designated as OSIs using expert judgment. So if there is, even if there is an indicator-based phase in this OSI score, there is also a very much subjective phase where these banks are designated as systemically important simply by decision. This is something that is actually disclosed in the document. They say that this indicator-based phase is there just to ensure that those banks that should be designated as systemically important will be designated as systemically important. And then there's this second stage where we use this expert judgment. It's meant for polishing and for meant to make this score more accurate in the national context. If there are some banks that are dominant in some variable in some country, the experts or the supervisors of this country can use their judgment to designate these banks as systemically important, even if the indicator-based methodology fails to designate them as such. European Systemic Risk Board, well, they published a quite critical publication last year. They argue that the OSI buffer calibration methods in the euro area countries vary very widely, and there are differences both in the designation and buffer calibration of OSIs. And as a result of this, there is very much heterogeneity in OSI buffer rates that cannot be explained by differences in these banks' systemic significance. Then this EBA, last year, it recommended a harmonized calibration method for this OSI framework. I showed this bucketing approach. This EBA recommends that it should be used for dividing banks into buckets, similarly to the GSIP framework. But there are banking systems where national systemic importance is measured using a national scope. I showed a moment ago that we use a global scope in calculating even national significance. I have been told that in the UK they use national scope for calculating this OSI score. They include only assets and liabilities that actually locate inside the UK, and then they measure systemic importance relative to this aggregate. That is the other way to do this, but this is very much not encouraged by the designer of the OSI score, because it may be that the local taxpayers may have to pay for the damages of these failed activities outside the domestic borders. It is ultimately the taxpayers that are protected by these frameworks, because investors' funds are required to ensure the solvency of these banks. And it is not really a nice idea. Well, I have excluded everything else, included only UK on this map, because the other way to interpret this kind of approach is that do they not care about the rest of the world? If there are assets and liabilities outside the borders, don't they really matter when they measure systemic importance? There has been debate about this. There are jurisdictions that have required, for example, Bank of Spain has debated that this systemic importance should be measured by using this domestic aggregates, but the ECB is strongly against this because the ECB argues that they simply cannot give the message that they don't mind about life outside the euro area borders. It makes sense, of course, but the criticism itself, it's quite justified, because if Nordea changes its headquarters from Sweden to Finland, it doesn't make other Finnish banks any less important, any less systemically significant. So if the UK uses this national aggregates for measuring systemic importance, it is quite justified in the sense because they have these large bank giants. For example, the HSBC, it had the largest cross-jurisdictional score of all the banks in the world. So because this HSBC domiciles in the UK, it makes the banks that operate only in the UK look systemically much less significant, which causes inaccuracy in these OSI scores. But this was everything that I had to say today. I was again too hasty. We still have 30 minutes of time. Do you have any questions?
I was just wondering, couldn't there be like a three-stage sub-scores? One at the national level, then another at the euro level, and then another at the international level. And it could be used like intertwined or to measure some kind of aggregate risk or systemic importance instead of like this binary system that is.
Shala, it's funny that you said that, because this is exactly what I propose when I work at the ECB. We had a project on this OSI and GSIP scores. This is what came to my mind as well. Proposed that could we have two scored instead of one, then just pick the largest of them and use that to measure systemic importance. But probably then I left the ECB, so probably it led nowhere. But yes, well, at least in my opinion, could be. Why not? There could be several scores. Maybe there will be in the future, because the problems in the OSI scores, they are so obvious.
I understand that national banks can be of huge importance in a country, and if they mirrors somehow limit the competition or the growth. So of course they want to protect their own national banks.
And in the euro area, we have several banking groups that operate mostly inside their domestic borders, because we have these very large cooperative banking sectors. We have a savings bank sector in Germany. There is cooperative banking Crédit Agricole in France, and so on and so on. These banks mostly operate in their countries, whereas these commercial banks of the same countries, they operate globally. And they make these domestic banks look smaller than they actually are, which causes very much inaccuracy in these OSI scores. Anything else? Is there online something?
It seems that there are no questions here from the Zoom. So Jari-Mikko, many thanks for this today's presentation. And tomorrow you will continue also at 9 o'clock.
Yeah.
And then we will continue with my lectures today, 12:15 in Ylistö. So see you guys there. And thanks, Jari-Mikko, and see you all tomorrow.
Okay.
Okay, thank you.